I call this meeting of the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy to order. Members of the audience, we've started. Members of the audience, please, we've started. There is a quorum present, and as a reminder to the public, the only public testimony we will be taking on the bills are from individuals who signed up in advance per the agenda posting on the committee webpage. Before we get into the bills, do we have a motion to approve the minutes for March 17, 2023?
Yes, Chair, so moved.
Representative Curran moves the minutes for March 17, 2023. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and the minutes for March 17, 2023 are approved. The first bill we have on the agenda is House File 1075. This is Representative Backer's bill. Welcome to the committee, Representative Backer. I will move to lay over House File 1075, and I see that you have an A1 amendment. I will move your amendment, and would you like to explain it to us, please?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. A1 amendment really talks about the funding source. I've been working on this for a number of years, and it changes the funding source to the from the general fund, working with the Department of Public Safety. This is really the best, and other stakeholders, we needed to get the bill in order per what we're seeing fiscally this year. So that's what the amendment does, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. Now, Representative Backer, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. As some of you know, I volunteer as an EMT for the Browns Valley Ambulance Service, so communication in all EMS, police, and fire is urgent, not just to provide care for our patients as an EMS, EMT, but also for the safety of those individuals who are providing that public service. This here is just some of the letters to support this. We have roughly 91,000, that is correct, 91,000 active radios in Minnesota. Working with the Department of Public Safety, 60% of those current radios are out of date, and they cannot find parts for them. So we are at a point that communication for when your constituents call 911 may not, those emergency technicians, fire, police, may not be able to communicate. Just a little history. Prior to 9/11, we could not communicate. For example, if I needed to talk to the fire chief for help, because some of my area as an EMS goes into Ortonville's area, our ambulance, we could not. But after 9/11, I could be in Browns Valley, Minnesota, and if I wanted to talk to someone in Duluth, I could. That is extremely powerful. And 2 years ago, we had a situation in the Clinton, Minnesota, that we had an elevator fire, and we had 19 agencies that were able to communicate. That's phenomenal. It saved the town. It saved lives. And that is something that we as legislators, it is a very important for us to provide good public safety. So if you take 60% of 91,000 active radios with the low average cost of $4,500 per radio, that comes to $245 million just to replace things that are outdated and so forth. So I'm glad that the other body has heard this bill, but the $5 million that the other body has put aside for this bill doesn't really do what we need to do to provide the public safety what our citizens come to expect. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to our testifier. I know we have roughly 10 minutes, so I'm going to turn it over to Chief Henderson from the Ortonville Fire Department, if you could come up.
Yep. All right. Great. Yeah. Thank you, Chief. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Hi. My name's Charles Henningsen. I served 21 years in the Minnesota National Guard, 2 tours to Iraq. I'm currently in my 22nd year of the Ortonville Fire Department and my 4th year as a chief there. To explain the importance of the armor system in our area, I'm going to walk you through a hypothetical call. It's a 2-car head-on collision with 4 injuries on the far side of our coverage. The call goes out simultaneously to Ortonville Fire, Ortonville Ambulance, Big Stone County Sheriff, and the Life Flight. the vicinity 14 miles from our fire hall. Immediately, all the entities would realize that we need backup due to the distance and the amount of victims. Then the call, we'd call for Odessa and Clinton Fire, Appleton Ambulance, Milbank Ambulance, and Stevens County Sheriff. These range from 17 to 30 miles away. We haven't even started helping victims, and we have 9 separate agencies responding to this one call. Without the armor system, no one could communicate. We could not land a helicopter at the scene, and the chance of getting patients to advanced care in a golden hour are almost nil. The armor system doesn't need line of sight, the representative said. These towers communicate with without this, we can only talk to the radios within a couple miles, making it possible to talk to other departments in our coverage. These radios are force multipliers for the distance of our coverage zones and smaller departments. This radio quit working 2 weeks ago at a call to the Ortonville School. We have 10 left. They're obsolete and not be able to fix. Last year, our fire protection charge per township for 36 square miles was less money than this one radio. We have no way financially to replace them when they break and keep up the maintenance of the rest of our equipment. A good example why I think this is necessary for all the emergency responders is if you read the after-action review of the Texas school shooting, the criticism of the Uvalde police chief was he took his weapon instead of the radio into that school. This caused a lack of communication that caused even more confusion, time wasted, resulting in more loss of life. This illustrates the importance of a multi-agency radio system. Without state-level funding, we're not able to access advantages of the armor system in the future. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Rebecca Young. Welcome to the committee. And when you make your way to the table, please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to present on behalf of House File 1075. This has been a multi-year effort to try to get some funding for our rural radios. I think the chief demonstrated a very, very great case of how that can help. I work directly with our emergency manager, who's our local armor systems administrator. One of the very first things I got asked when I joined public service 9 years ago in my role was how are we going to get these paid for and how quickly can we get these replaced? As you know, armor radio system is the backbone of public safety and emergency response across the state of Minnesota. Continuing to provide a high level of service and our best response, we need law enforcement, EMS, first responders, and firefighters to have maintained equipment that's up to date. Armor radio system was a mandate that was given to local governments and other agencies across the state. The goal was interoperability to provide the highest level of safety and response. And guess what? It does work. We test this annually during our emergency management exercises and during actual emergencies. It allows for seamless delivery of services that would not otherwise be possible. One of the biggest challenges that you've heard is the funding and the cost associated with maintenance and repair. Well over 10 years ago, our county received a large grant that allowed us to transition over to armor. During that time, our emergency manager has been diligent about applying for small grants since then, and when she can, the county board also levies and supports replacement. But it's been a couple of year 2 to 3. Even with that concentrated effort, Stevens County alone is looking at a total replacement cost of $996,000 for a complete system upgrade. There are many counties that have not even had the luxury to levy and be able to do this on an annual basis. Granting funding to the armor radio replacement is equal to direct property tax relief in a county of our size. If we were to levy for that, the system replacement would be about a 12.5% levy increase and then ongoing funding of a 2 to 3% levy impact. Another area of need that the chief spoke about is our rural emergency response departments. These are largely ran by volunteers. These departments have inadequate funding sources. They looked at partnerships with local government for funding, or they fundraise personally for it in their communities for their equipment replacement and their operations. Granting funding would help these small agencies stay viable and allow them to provide critical services to our rural population. Replacement radios can cost anywhere from $2,500 to $6,000 a piece, depending on type and need. On top of that, they need multiple battery replacements and programming. Radios purchased years ago by agencies all across the state are reaching the end of their useful life. Not only that, but the support of the products is not available, and neither is replacement parts. There's a critical need across all 87 counties for funding to update this quickly aging systems. All of us, we are all partners in public safety and emergency response. And to continue to provide a high level of service and response, we need your help and agreement to help fund this aging system. I urge you to consider supporting this critical piece of infrastructure for our future. It will save lives, speed response time, and allow counties and agencies all across the state to provide the highest level of response. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony. We did not have anyone from the public sign up to testify on this bill, so we will move to member discussion. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Backer, as I'm a co-author on this, I understand the need, as this is my space. And we part of the need here is also the overarching fact that funding for EMS, fire, and police in outstate is not substantial. Radios are such a key factor to what we do, and I remember back in the earlier days, oh, the cell phones are going to come, we can get rid of these radios. Well, we tried that, and it didn't work at all. Because when you need somebody on the click of the radio, and you need help now. And that's why we're still in using radios for that sake. It's unbelievable when you've been in a situation where it's inoperable. And I can understand the fact of, especially in your area, Representative Backer, and in that western part, where you could easily be 100 miles from a hospital, and you need to talk to the doctor, and you need to get some orders. And when you have a radio that really is from the 1980s that isn't hitting the towers or whatever, you're in trouble, because now it leaves you totally blind to what you have to do for that patient. The same thing for law enforcement, the same thing for fire. The incident command system that we have is built around constant communication, everybody being on the same page, and when we don't have our communication network, it's a problem. The other factor here is, and I think we have to look at the attention here of the $250 million that you asked for in the bill. That's a substantial amount, and the sad thing is that's probably just the start. Because we're looking, again, as I go back to the funding mechanism that we have for EMS, fire, and police, we really need to revisit this and how we make sure that our outstate partners can get the funds they need for everything. So I wish we could, just say this is a great magic fix, but it's not. And I really appreciate you working on this, Representative Backer. You've done it for years since I've been in the legislature. And I hate to tell you this, but I don't think your work is over yet. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Whitty.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Thank you, Representative Backer, for bringing this forward. I agree with Representative Hewitt. In an emergency, communication is important. In that inoperable moments where that when the communication breaks down, that's when the problems happen. When in my former career, I was a part of rolling out the radio system and having a plan to kind of move forward. And unfortunately, it sounds like everything's kind of gone away. There's no solutions at this point. Many bonding and other appropriations for local projects require a local match of 50 or at least 25%. This requires a 5% non-match. Why such a low match? Would it be beneficial if it was a little bit more higher at that point?
Representative Becker.
Yeah, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Whitty. There's a report that was done by the Department of Public Safety, and the challenges that we have in not just greater Minnesota but regional and even in the metro area, a lot of our emergency care is done by volunteer fire departments and ambulance services. I'll use Browns Valley Ambulance as an example. Right now, every year, myself, my wife, and my twin brother, along with the staff, we do a fundraiser just so we can get the rig out, just so we can keep our expenses paid, not buying radios like the chief showed the radio that is no longer operable, and we have those on our service. We raised $31,000, which is phenomenal. Roughly this year we did 37. So the reason for that low match is when we are out there and someone needs help, I think it's something the state should be doing. This is public safety. This is our responsibility. And I'm pleased that the chair decided to hear this bill from a member that's not from her party, because she recognizes that this is a nonpartisan issue. This is safety. When any of your children or your grandchildren or your members need help, you expect them to show up. And I've had equipment failure. I've never had a radio failure, but I've had equipment failure. I had one about seven weekends ago. Your stress level goes through the roof. Imagine if you have a school shooting and you can't communicate. I can tell you that's going to be stressful. I've been in not that situation, but I've been in life and death situations that I've had equipment failure. And that feels bad. That's not why I volunteer. You want to be able to deliver that service to your children, to your grandchildren, to your neighbor's kids, and to your friends. So that's why I did the low 5%.
Any follow-up? Representative Woody.
Thank you for that answer. And we got to learn from our lessons. And after 9/11, they said the number one thing that cost a lot of lives in that was communication in the radios. So I'm supportive, and I hope this bill can go move forward. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and thank you for bringing this bill, Representative Backer. As I just sit back, I think maybe we need to explain it, put it in a little different perspective of, you know, instead of calling it a radio, let's call it what it is. It's a highly advanced computer that's got to be hardened to the point that it can withstand 30 below to 100 degrees above, and the daily banging of riding around in a car and falling and tripping and rain and snow and sleet. And think about your phone that you have to replace because it magically knows when your warranty is going to run out, and that crashes on you. You know, in the meantime, you've got a portable radio, an 800 radio that's gone through, you know, lasted longer than three of my phones. As someone who started law enforcement before we had a portable that was even worth carrying, we had the old fire pager. So once you got out of the car, if dispatch wanted you, they had to trip the fire pager. Then you had to find a phone. Once you've had a system like the Armor that works, it is great. And I think we need to, as everyone else would agree on this panel, on both sides, we can't go back. And I speak in favor of this bill. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Closing remarks, Representative Backer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, members. And I agree with Representative Novotny. He nailed it. Communication, and we heard from our testifiers, is the most important. If we do not know where to go and what to do, we can't use our skills to help people. It's somewhat similar to what happened to me Friday morning with helping Representative Keel. She knew who to call. Of course, she got a hold of me, and I was able to help her. It's no different than your constituents. When they dial 911, if it's fire, like Ortonville, if it's police, like what Representative Novotny served as a deputy, or myself and my other colleagues, when help is needed, we need to be communicate. And also, back to Representative Witte's question, 90% of all agencies in Minnesota, we have need some type of help because of the cost of this radio system. So really appreciate you considering this. This is so vital. This is so vital for public safety, and Minnesota is recognized across the nation to provide good emergency care. Less still lead, and we need this communication channel continue to grow to be able to provide good care when someone dials 911, and hopefully none of you will have to do it, but if you do, we want quick recovery time for your family and your neighbors. So thank you so much. Take care.
Thanks again, Representative Backer, and to your testifiers, and to those who submitted letters that are in the members' packets and are online. With that, I renew my motion and lay over House File 1075 as amended. The next bill we have on the agenda is House File 2415. It's Representative Norris' bill. And before I move that bill, just for all the testifiers who are in the audience, every testifier with a bill author was told 2 minutes to testify, and anybody from the public signed up was told 90 seconds. So I don't want to have to cut anybody off, but just giving that warning in advance. And also, people have submitted letters of support in the packets. I will move that House File 2415 be re-referred to the Committee on Housing, Finance, and Policy. This bill is in our committee because of the reporting requirement to the state fire marshal in Section 2 of the bill. Representative Knorr, I don't see any amendments, so please tell us about your bill.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Thank you so much for the opportunity to bring this bill forward and also discuss this bill. November 27, 2019, a tragic accident happened in our district where we lost five individuals. Those five individuals died in high-rise fire. It happened on the 14th floor. It was a cold day, windy. Fortunately, the building that they were in did not have any fire sprinklers. And the report from the fire marshal clearly indicated if we had fire sprinkler in that building, we could have saved lives. That prompted us to take action to do not only this bill, but the previous one where we required public housings to have sprinklers. I'm here to report to you that as I speak to you, Minneapolis Public Housing, all their high-rise buildings, more than 26 buildings, now have got a plan to retrofit fire sprinklers. Madam Chair and members, this bill just requires the cities to report to the fire marshal any building that is about 75 feet, which is above the ladder of the fire. This is about safety. It's about making sure that we protect the lives of individuals, but also the firefighters who are going to be carrying heavy equipment on a high-rise building just to get people out to extinguish the fire. In any given fire, you need three things. You need a fire sprinkler. You need firefighters. You also need to have fire alarm. So with that, Madam Chair, we'll let my testifier stick to the bill in details.
Thank you, Chair Knorr. And I see that you have Tom Brace. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Madam Chair, my name and committee members, my name is Tom Brace. I'm the former Minnesota State Fire Marshal from 1987 to 2003. And prior to that, I was the Washington State Fire Marshal for 10 years. Residents should have safety in their homes, particularly on floors where the fire truck ladders and hoses cannot reach. And there is no easy escape. Many residents living in high-rise residential buildings have mobility issues. This bill provides funding for grants as an incentive rather than a mandate to retrofit fire sprinklers to high-rise residential buildings. The reporting requirement from cities to the state fire marshal is critical to inform the state as to the number of unsprinklered high-rise buildings. Great efforts have been made by the League of Cities, the State Fire Marshal, and the National Fire Sprinkler Association, who I represent, to survey the need. But there remains unanswered questions. After reaching out to every jurisdiction with a population over 1,000, we learned the following. There are 18 unsprinklered high-rise buildings, 56 partially sprinklered, and this is the most concerning, 65 for which we have no information on other than that there is a building. There has been a historic reporting relationship between the State Fire Marshal and the Fire Service of Minnesota. Fire data reporting, we lead the nation in number of percentage of fire departments who report to the State Fire Marshal. We see that as a very good working relationship already established. Therefore, we respectfully ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you. And we did have one member of the public who signed up to testify. David Ybarra, please come down and introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is David Ybarra. I'm president of the Minnesota Pipe Trades Association. an organization representing more than 9,000 men and women working in the plumbing, pipe fitting, and fire protection industries throughout the state of Minnesota. Minnesota Pipe Trades Association is proud to support House File 2415 and respectfully asks that all members of the committee join in passing this vital public safety legislation. This bill is similar to legislation introduced previously in response to the tragic high-rise fire that killed five Minnesotans in November 2019. The state fire marshal has testified that since 2004, there have been 65 fires in Minnesota that started on or above the seventh floor of a building, the vast majority of them being multifamily high-rise dwellings. In cases where automatic fire suppression sprinklers were present, all fires were quickly contained or extinguished. Conversely, the fire marshal has concluded that the lack of an automatic sprinkler system in the apartment where the fire originated in November 2019 was a major factor in the deaths that occurred. The State Fire Marshal Division report on the Minneapolis high-rise fire concluded, "It is State Fire Marshal Division's position that all high-rise buildings should be protected with fire sprinkler systems. Had this building been protected with fire sprinklers, it is the opinion of the department that no loss of life would have occurred. In short, it is the universal opinion of firefighting professionals that automatic fire suppression systems in high-rise buildings save lives. We are pleased to join with our public safety partners in supporting this bill. These tragic deaths are avoidable. Installing fire suppression systems is the best way to achieve that. I thank you and again ask for your support."
Thank you for your testimony. And to both of you, you kept under your time limits that you were given. We appreciate that. Nobody else from the public signed up to testify, so we will move now to member discussion. Lee Novotny.
Thanks, Chair Mueller. Representative Knorr, is there any federal money available for this? Have you looked at that? I believe that that was covered in some of the past bills.
Chair Knorr.
Madam Chair, I think the funding for the federal funds went straight to Minneapolis building. So there was a small portion that came through. And that's why I noted that Minneapolis Public Housing now is going to retrofit all their buildings with fire sprinkler. But there isn't any ongoing funding that is available that I'm aware of.
Yep. Lee Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Representative Nortz, so Minneapolis is already taken care of. Is that, help me understand, is this in addition to that we're looking at? Or how many buildings have been taken care of in Minneapolis with the funding that we've already done?
Yep, and I'll let you answer that, but I'll just note that before us is Section 2, the reporting requirement. So go ahead, Chair Knorr.
Representative Butney, I think the question about Minneapolis public housing, the city allocated funds, and also the public housing used some of their funds, and they also got federal funds. So that is Minneapolis public housing, but not every housing in the city of Minneapolis. So as an example in this bill, we want to make sure there are two high-rise buildings in Seward neighborhood that really needs the sprinklers right now. So we carved out for them. So that's the only thing that I can tell you right now, but we have a lot of other buildings that we need to make sure that they report to the cities, and we can come back and figure out how we can address that issue.
One last question.
Yep, go ahead. Lena
very, very quickly. Thanks, Chair Mueller. Representative Knorr, about how much per unit are we talking?
Chair Knorr.
Madam Chair and members, I think the estimates that we got a long time ago is about 3,000, but it can go up. We know the costs have been going up recently.
Thank you, Chair.
Any closing comments, Chair Knorr?
Thank you, Madam Chair, for giving me the opportunity to hear this bill. This is a good bill. I hope you support it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And I renew my motion that House File 2415 be re-referred to the Committee on Housing, Finance, and Policy. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Oppose? The motion prevails. Thanks again. Next up, we have House File 1273. It's a Representative Tabke bill. I will move to lay over House File 1273. There are no amendments filed on your bills, so go ahead and tell us about it.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. So House File 1273 is local emergency management grants. And so this appropriates $3 million a year in state funds to the 87 counties, 11 tribes, and four cities of the first class that are currently eligible for federal to receive federal funding, and so the funds will be distributed equally, which will leave approximately $29,000 per eligible entity. And so our local governments are heavily dependent on federal grants, and the federal grants, especially in greater Minnesota, are becoming less reliable in the, while at the same time the natural disasters we face are increasing. And so Minnesota state, local, and tribal governments need additional resources to sustain and enhance emergency management capabilities. And there's a lack of stable and sustainable funding for both state and local emergency management planning and operations. And so today we are working to help with that issue. And I have two testifiers, John Bowen and Gary Johnson. Madam Chair.
All right, great. And if the two of you want to come down to the testifier table, I'm not sure who wants to go first. So whoever wants to go first, just please start and introduce yourself. Welcome to both of you to the committee.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks. Well, my name is Gary Johansson. I am Norman County's emergency manager. I am past president of AMAM, which is an association of Minnesota emergency managers, and I sit on the government affairs committee. Thank you, Representative Papke, for co-authoring this bill, this very important initiative bill. And Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for taking the time. My colleague and I are the faces of emergency management. We are also the boots on the ground for emergency management. We both believe that and agree that disasters start local and they end local. So what exactly does that mean? For us, our core principles in emergency management are mitigation, preparation, response, and recovery. I'm going to tell you right now, I've already prepared my documents for a state of emergency in Norman County, which is Ada, Minnesota, for a disaster. We're going to flood this spring. There's just no question about it. So what do we do with those four core principles? Mitigation, we've already moved homes and outbuildings out of the floodways. What do we do in preparedness? We go around to all our townships, our counties, and our cities, which I have eight of them, and we prepare them. We tell them what resources we have, what do you need, sandbag, sand machine, what can we do for you? In the response, as the rivers recede, which they usually do, hopefully, I go in and do initial damage assessments, get those numbers together, dollar figures on what it's going to cost to fix everything, send them to the state. And recovery, what do we do there? I don't rush in and fix the roads. I in the middle person to help get that money from the state or feds, if it's a FEMA disaster, back to the locals where we end. So the problem is, and I've heard this before in other testimony, there's a lack of sustainable and stable funding. I get in Norman County $15,000 a year from the feds to operate a program that was supposed to be part-time, now has become full-time. So with that, I'm here to support House File 1273, and I'm going to hand it off to my colleague after Chair, Madam Chair, passes the baton.
Thank you so much. Yep. Thanks for coming down here. We appreciate it. All right, next we have John Bowen. Welcome. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, John Bowen from Emergency Management Director for Crow Wing County, also a past president of the Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers, and also as the chair for our Government Affairs and Education Committee. Again, thank you again. Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. This bill will greatly enhance the emergency management programs throughout the state. Like Representative Tapke said, it's 87 counties, 11 tribal nations, along with the four cities of the first class. With the increase in disasters over the last many years, this allocation will really help us better prepare, respond, recover, and mitigate for these events in the past, and also the ones that we know that we're coming. Like Gary said, the whole state right now is watching our flood outlook. And emergency managers across the state right now are planning and preparing for a pretty likely significant flooding across the statewide of Minnesota this spring. Just in Crow Wing County in 2022, we declared three local disaster declarations, two state, one went federal. We're just about wrapping up our federal one from Memorial Day of last year. And we're starting on our June storm, and then we're still working on our December 13th through the 16th storm, which we're still in the recovery phase of that because it was a snowstorm that we encountered. We still have a lot of debris still to remove. And during all these disasters and response times, the emergency managers across state still have to fulfill and meet their state and federal mandates. I'd just like to thank the House of Representatives for supporting this bill the last 4 years, and a special thanks to Representatives Tapke, Novotny, Curran, Johnson, Hewitt, Torkelson, Brand, and O'Driscoll for supporting this bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thanks for your testimony and for being here today. We appreciate it. We did not have anybody from the public sign up to testify, so we will move on to member discussion. Lead Novotny.
Hey, thank you, Chair Moeller. Representative Tapke, why the carve-out for the four Class A cities?
Representative Tapke.
Madam Chair and Representative Novotny, that is mimicking what the federal guidelines are.
Lead Novotny.
Thank you, Chair.
Seeing no other questions, go ahead with closing comments. Representative Tapke.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. So as you see in your packet today, there is a letter from Department of Public Safety for support for the bill, as some other line items as to how this money can and will be used to make sure that communities across the state of Minnesota are assisted in preparing for emergencies. So thank you very much, and I look forward to folks' support.
Thank you. I renew my motion and lay over House File 1273. The next bill we have on the agenda is House File 2026. It's a Representative Hewitt bill. I will move to lay over House File 2026. I don't see that we have any amendments that have been filed. So when you make your way to the table, go ahead, Representative Hewitt, and tell us about your bill.
Is that a challenge? Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee, for indulging us in sprinkler day, I guess, right? House File 2026, simply, is a bill that allows the Fire Marshal Division to retain the revenues generated each year through issuing permits and conducting sprinkler plan reviews. This new funding would go towards the work done by the State Fire Marshal's Office. This could include additional staffing, training sprinkler and pipe fitters, and upkeep and maintenance by the State Fire Marshal's Office. Today with me I have two testifiers, and I'd like to turn it over to, if it's okay with Madam Chair, turn it over to former Fire Marshal Tom Bryce to go into a 10,000-foot view of the bill.
All right, yes, that's fine. And even though you just testified, if you could please introduce yourself again and begin your
Certainly.
Testimony.
My name is Tom Brace, and I don't believe my credentials have changed in the last few minutes. I would like to publicly thank Representative Hewitt for authoring House File 2026. What we are asking to do, and Representative Hewitt outlined, we are asking to dedicate the revenue collected from the sprinkler contractors through the fees they pay for fire suppression plan reviews, sprinkler permits, and more into a dedicated account for public safety purpose, which was the original intent in the early 90s when the legislation was passed. These fees were not dedicated at the time of the law when it was passed because the state of Minnesota lost a major lawsuit with Cambridge Bank. And historically, you might want to look that one up, but the bottom line is it ceased to exist as a dedicated account. Many new revenue sources, including the fire protection fees, were diverted from their intended purpose to pay for the monetary damages assessed by the court. The lack of sufficient revenue has kept the program understaffed and unable to keep up with the needs. At this point, I would like to turn my chair over to John Nishja. As John makes his way to the front, John has a 44-year career in the fire service, 33 of which were a wide variety of positions in the State Fire Marshal Division, and recently retired. John.
All right. Welcome to the committee. John Nishja, please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity. My name is John Nishja. I'm a fire protection and data specialist for the National Fire Sprinkler Association out of Minnesota. I've had the honor and privilege of serving for 44 years as a firefighter, fire marshal, and now my career with the Sprinkler Association. So from 2005 until I retired last August, I supervised the state fire marshal's fire protection and data sections. So over the last 15 years, the state fire marshal has conducted an average of 462 plan reviews each year. That equals about 153 for each of the three plan reviewers that did that work. That's a very high workload. The typical sprinkler plan review takes 4 to 6 hours. Some of them involve days, and some of them, although rare, could take weeks to conduct. So that high workload does not allow adequate time for those plan reviewers to do other jobs, such as field inspections, investigations of licensing complaints, or rule violations, or to conduct training and continuing education for members of the industry and for local code officials who inspect these systems. So passage of this bill, House File 2026, will move somewhere between $480,000 to $500,000 from fees into this new special revenue account, allowing for additional staff for the State Fire Marshal Division. So with that additional staff complement, the State Fire Marshal Office would be able to conduct more on-site inspections of fire protection system installations. They'll be able to review or reduce the plan review turnaround time. Our goal has always been 2 to 4 weeks, and it's taken significantly longer to do that. That will result in fewer delays in the construction industry, turn over buildings faster, get them occupied faster, get their financing in place, and so on. Also provide training for fire sprinkler contractors, for the installers, for the designers, also for the local code enforcement officials who must review these systems also. Also provide additional resources to investigate violations. Most of our contractors are very reputable, very good contractors, but occasionally we do run into one that cuts some corners, and the state fire marshal has limited resources to do those investigations. The other thing is this bill would establish consistency with the Department of Labor and Industry, whose fees that they collect for inspections and plan reviews all go into a special revenue account for their services. So we ask that you support the passage of House File 2026 and allow this important life safety program to continue and to ensure that fire suppression systems are properly designed and installed, reviewed and permitted properly, and adequately maintained, thereby protecting the citizens and serving the industry for the state of Minnesota. Madam Chair, thank you very much. Members of the committee, appreciate the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you for your testimony. And between the two of you, boy, a lot of experience there. And thank you for your years of service to our state. Really appreciate it. We did not have any members of the public sign up in advance to testify, so we will move on to member discussion. Anybody? Lead Novotny? Anyone?
Thank you, Chair Moore.
Go ahead.
If the previous bill we talked about goes through, there'll be a spike in the funding. Are we going to have carry through with this? And is there a plan for what happens when we have a slowdown in this licensing?
Representative Hewitt.
Do you understand the question? He's really soft-spoken, so you got to listen.
Do you need him to repeat the question?
Please.
Yes, go ahead, Representative Nabani.
As we saw in the bill we heard before that, if that goes through, there'll be a spike in the funding. Do we have a plan for carryover in years? Eventually we'll get to the point where we won't have this spike. Do we have a funding plan for that? Will this carry through?
Madam Chair, Lead Novotny, possibly, but I think the plan here is to get in the position so when we have more of these installs going on, that we have adequate funds to train so we're not always in an enforcement state, and also adequate funds to enforce to make sure we don't have bad players, because if the funding comes, then we're going to have, yes, a rush, and we want to make sure it's done right. So I think we're looking at the enforcement arm here, and it's really neutral because they're collecting fees and putting them into a special fund for enforcement. And also what I like most about this bill is really that even they correct it. They go out, they train, making sure that it gets done.
Lee Nabani.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. And yeah, I agree. I love the idea that we're segregating this and keeping out of the general fund. Thank you.
All right, not seeing any further comments, so go ahead and give us your closing comments, Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I want to thank the two gentlemen that were here today. I've known them since I've been in EMS, and they've been around everywhere, so their years of service now in their golden years, but they're still trying to save lives and doing stuff like this. So, but like, I want to just reiterate that what I really like about this bill is that it's not just an enforcement bill, but it's also a training bill so we can make things better with the players. Thank you, Madam Chair, for listening to the bill.
Thank you, and I'll renew my motion and lay over House File 2026. Thanks again. Next up, we have Representative Feist's bill, House File 46, and I will move to lay over House File 46. As Vice Chair Feist makes her way up to the table, I'll note that we have a DE1 author's amendment. Vice Chair Feist, would you like to move the DE1 amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would.
And since the DE is delete everything, we'll move straight to the vote. All those in favor of the DE1 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails and the DE1 amendment is adopted. All right, Vice Chair Feist, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee. House File 46 will create an Office of Youth Restorative Practices within the Department of Public Safety, or the Office of Children, Youth, and Families, if such office is created. This office will provide structure around building capacity to use restorative practices and administer a grant program and provide technical assistance and oversight. Research is clear that community-based approaches are more effective responses for children and families in crisis, involved in the juvenile justice system, and struggling with other social problems. The broad purpose of restorative practices is to identify the underlying causes of behavior and empower children, families, and communities to take an active role in the prevention and early intervention of behaviors that may lead to involvement in juvenile delinquency, child protection, out-of-home placement, and other areas that negatively impact families. Given the research on the effectiveness of community-based approaches, in addition to the large disparities in placements of children of color in Minnesota, it is in the state's interest to encourage the use of restorative practices throughout the state. We have seen the effectiveness of these programs in other states that have implemented statewide restorative justice initiatives, such as Colorado. We have also seen the successes of restorative practices in communities across Minnesota, such as Yellow Medicine County, Pine County, Ramsey County, and Hennepin County. The ultimate goal of this bill is to encourage and support these practices that have been demonstrated to dramatically reduce out-of-home placement, provide greater solace for those harmed, ensure meaningful accountability for youth, and to enhance public safety. And I would like to take a moment to thank the experts who I've worked with over the past 2 years on this labor of love. And I'm really excited to finally be presenting this bill. I think it's really important step forward for the state of Minnesota. And on a more mundane note, this bill does a couple of other things. In the interest of efficiency, we have also added to this bill a request by the Department of Corrections to move the Juvenile Detention Alternatives Initiative, or JDAI, from DOC to Metro State. And it also adds in funding for dual status or crossover youth, which is children who are involved in the child welfare system and the juvenile justice system. It's a bill that was introduced last year. I thought it was introduced this year, but it hadn't. So I added it to my bill because one of the really key areas when I talk with juvenile justice experts is that we have kids who are impacted by both systems, and there's not as much coordination between services as there could be. And that is the bill. With that, I'm going to turn it over to my amazing experts, and we do have even more experts in the room who are excited to be here and are able to answer questions, too, once we get to member discussion.
All right. Thank you. First up, we have Sharon Hendricks. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Hi. My name is Sharon Hendricks. I am the Restorative Justice Department head for Yellow Medicine County, and I've been a restorative practitioner for 20 years. We began our journey with restorative practices in 2002 when a committed group of stakeholders, led in training by the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe and Dakota teachers, wanted to do better by children and families as the rate of out-of-home placements for delinquency-involved youth had skyrocketed. We started with circle sentencing and began seeing the benefits of communities caring for and holding each other accountable. Placement costs decrease, and what began as an attempt to address delinquency files has evolved into restorative practices being used to mitigate child in need of protection petitions, revolving incarcerations, crisis placements for youth, multiple treatment placements for adults, truancy petitions, and has created networks of support for families seeking reunification. As communities, families, and children have become empowered and have broken long-standing cycles, numerous success stories can be shared. Three stories of Circle participants stand out. One youth who committed a felony, burglary, and theft completed Circle sentencing, including making amends to those most impacted by his behavior, and was able to go later to law enforcement school and is now a deputy sheriff. A mother who was able to transition from prison, complete treatment, remain on a sober path, and reunify with her child through the support of Circles in the community. And finally, a young man who by the time he was 25 had been in more than 5 delinquency placements, multiple incarcerations, and 8 treatment facilities decided to try Circle. And this is what he had to say after being 3 years sober. I have a life because of Circle. The feedback from Circle of Hope kept me sober. After taking thousands and thousands of dollars from the community, it's the greatest feeling to give back. If we can plant the seed and save one life, it's worth it. These three and many more have now given back in immeasurable ways to our communities as volunteers. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Reese Fredrickson. And then on deck, we have Kelly O'Rourke. Welcome. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Reese Fredrickson. I am the County Attorney of Pine County. In 2016, my office, in partnership with County Probation, County Health and Human Services, the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe, local schools, and many community partners started a juvenile restorative justice program. We started our program because we wanted to address the generational issue of justice-involved youth. I personally became interested in trying a different approach when I continued to see over my years as a prosecutor children following in the steps of parents who were justice-involved. I felt we needed a different approach. We also needed a way to be more inclusive and address high disparities we saw with our Native American juveniles in our county and on probation. We formed our restorative justice program based around victim offender conferencing. The idea of this model is to allow the community, victim, and offender to have a voice in deciding the appropriate outcome. If the program involved Native American children, we had a tribal elder as part of this conference. If this program involved school discipline, we had the principal and school staff as part of it. Our program has been a success. We've had over 70 successful completions since it formed in 2016. Of those 70, about 9% have recidivated, with most of those involving misdemeanors. Compare that with recidivism rates around Minnesota, you're looking at 30%, and some as high as 66%, and often those involve recidivating on violent crime. We've also recovered thousands in restitution that goes directly to the victim so that the victim does not have to wait for a lengthy restitution recovery process. Our disparity numbers have been reduced by double digits. Our out-of-home placement costs have been cut in half, which I attribute in part to this program. The average length of time in the program is 90.5 days, which is quite less than a court proceedings. 95% of the juveniles in the program that started successfully completed. Restorative justice isn't easy. It's hard work, requires passionate people, and often requires a juvenile to do more work than traditional systems. House File 46 provides a state support for restorative justice so that all counties can benefit from these programs, and I urge you to support it. Thank you.
Thank you. And then we have Lieutenant Kelly O'Rourke. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you for having me. My name is Lieutenant Kelly O'Rourke. I work for Minneapolis Police, and I'm here to represent our department and the County Attorney's Office from Hennepin County. I've been with the Minneapolis Police for 25 years. I've worked in every violent crime entity of the city to include gangs, narcotics, homicide, robbery, and juvenile investigations. I currently manage the Metro-wide Task Force for Carjackings. I'm here to tell you that we're in a crisis, and the crisis is that about 98% of our offenders are juveniles. The system is broken. Representative Feist has done her homework and is very well studied on states that are doing it well. Colorado is one of them, as she mentioned. We support that restorative justice language that Colorado's been using. It does work. In their program, they've put forth 950 kids in their original study. 95% of those kids, or of those kids completed it with an 8.8% recidivism rate. So the data is there that it works. Minnesota does not have a system. It's putting law enforcement and our county attorney's office in a tough spot by returning these kids back into an environment that's broken. I believe, our county attorney's office believes, that this bill and the funding that comes along with it will help put those programs in place so we have something that we can do to give these kids a chance as they move forward.
Thank you for your testimony. We did have one member of the public signed up to testify, Reverend Kendall Hughes. Want to make your way down? Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Kendall Hughes. I am a retired federal prison chaplain and co-founder and the chair of the board for Three Rivers Restorative Justice in southeast Minnesota. Ernest Schaefer had spent 16 years being warehoused and becoming increasingly violent when he snuck up behind me in the prison chapel and stabbed me 12 times. He barely missed my carotid artery. Well, what the prison system and the assistant U.S. attorney, the prosecuting attorney, did following that was almost as traumatic as being stabbed. To Ernest, they put him 8 years in solitary confinement. They released him, and within a month, he assaulted two women and is now back in prison for life at great expense to taxpayers. For me, I never received any reparations. I never had a chance to ask him why. To this day, I don't know why he stabbed a chaplain. To this day, my family is still traumatized by that. We moved away from there as quickly as we could. It took 2 years for there to be finally a sentencing. Those 2 years, I had paranoia. I had depression. It was hard for me to go to work. I worked and worked and worked on the public impact statement. I had to travel 800 miles to give the statement. I sat in court all day long and they forgot me. The thing that gave me hope, the thing that lifted me out of that paranoia and that depression, and that transformed that terrible event in my life into something positive, was getting involved in restorative justice after that. For 20 years now, I have led restorative justice programs that have enabled people to have better experiences than I had the day when that judge forgot me. It gives people the chance to ask questions to the person who harmed them, why did you harm me, and get answers. It gives them a chance to get reparations. It gives them a chance to see that person make real changes, to not go back and do those kinds of things again. It gives them a chance to have a meaningful voice in what goes on. In the program that we run in southeast Minnesota, we mentioned the man before, we mentioned the carjacking. We just recently had a young man that stole a car, and the victim was able to come and to hear his story and work with him and to get him to do community service at a place where she volunteers. And when he went back before the judge, she stood there, the victim stood there beside him and said, "Judge, this man has changed, this young man has changed." She said, "I'm satisfied with what happened. I'm satisfied he will never do it again." We all were, and he was changed. I believe that people like me who have been harmed by crime deserve more than the current system. We need our current system, but we need something more also for people that have been harmed by crime. And I ask you to make sure that House File 46 advances and that we offer victims of crime in this community an additional alternative to the current system. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you for your testimony and for sharing your story with us. And thank you to all the testifiers who were here today and those of you who traveled to be here. Appreciate it. All right, so we only were taking public testimony from people who signed up, Mr. Hughes, so sorry, but you're my constituent and I'm glad to talk with you offline later as well. Let's see, so with that, we can move on to member discussions. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Feist. It's an interesting bill, an interesting concept, and at the core of what it is that you're trying to do and what is being done from the testimony that we've heard is a really solid idea, and that is confronting people with the impact of what it is that they've done, making it personal, making it relational,
to try to evoke that human connection that inspires us to make better choices. Kind of reminds me of parenting, right? I think back on my dad. My dad was old school. He was very law and order in the household. And the approach that I've chosen to take with my sons is more restorative, I guess you could say, in terms of hearing them out, granting them some grace, letting them discover things, but also knowing when it's time to metaphorically crack the whip and draw a line in the sand and say, no, you can't do that. I hope that part of it doesn't get lost in this. And I'm also concerned, and, you know, maybe this is our fault for, by that I mean the folks on my side of the table, for not engaging enough with this idea, that it might be drifting away from our ability to engage with it. And by that I mean, you know, when I look at the bill and I look at lines 212 through 219, this is kind of the resume or job description of the director of this office.
Hudson, can you are you talking about the DE?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry, can you say those lines again?
212 through 219.
Thank you.
It's where the director, the criteria or qualifications for the director are listed. And it lists things such as experience with the many facets of restorative justice, practices such as peacemaking circles. I have no idea what that is. Sentencing circles, community conferencing, and such. You skip down a little bit. It talks about knowledge of the range of social problems that bring children and families to points of crisis, such as poverty, racism, unemployment, and unequal opportunity. It very much sounds like a resume that's tailored towards a progressive activist, to be frank. And so my concern is that the value of what this office is intended to achieve is going to drift potentially in a very partisan direction, and for that reason the benefits won't be available to a broader segment of Minnesotans. So that's just my comment, and I appreciate any feedback you'd like to offer.
Yeah, and before I turn it to you, Vice Chair Feist, too, I'll just kind of note that the language about circles, I know one of your testifiers talked about that too. That's part of restorative justice. And so I know when I first started learning about it, I didn't really know what that meant either. And so when you address Representative Hudson's question, if you can also talk to that.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the question. I am going to turn it over to Sharon Hendricks if she'd like to come back. But basically, when I was looking at this bill and thinking about restorative practices and how we didn't want to be prescriptive, that these practices really do need to be led by community, reflect the values, the comfort level with stakeholders in the local communities and like their priorities. And what I was told is what we needed to do was clone 87 Sharons and deploy them across the state of Minnesota. But we didn't have cloning language, so we just tried to like create that in this language in this bill. So Sharon can tell you a little bit about the program in Yellow Medicine County. I think one of your questions was, sorry, I hope I didn't embarrass you, like how, that balance between like our woo-woo language and law and order and kind of how to strike that balance, and also just kind of about how effective the Yellow Medicine County's progress has been and over the past 20 years, because they have a restorative justice department, which is separate and apart from all of the other county departments. And so it's really unique. And it really is kind of like my vision for the state of Minnesota is to bring that statewide. So if you'd like to just say a few words about your background and how it has evolved over the past 20 years in the work in Yellow Medicine County. Thank you.
Thank you. And if you could also explain the circle
piece
of it and to
I,
it
I
as
wanted
well.
To leave that.
Yep, that would be great. Ms. Hendricks.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative, for your comments. In Yellow Medicine, it started with a group of committed stakeholders that wanted to do things differently because out-of-home placements costs were skyrocketing due to delinquency placements, specifically detention placements. As a result, we tried circle sentencing, which is a partnership with the systems and the community, and understanding that being in relationship and involving community and community voice can keep people safer. We saw a lot of people coming through Circle. We created our own criteria for what worked for our community and those involved in referring, which the bill language is our best hope that by having these advisory committees, that's where the balance comes in, is that everyone will create what works in their area, like we did in Yellow Medicine, and other communities create what works for the people in that community. What we saw was a significant decrease in the youth that were going into delinquency placements, and therefore said, let's apply the Circle practice then to other avenues, which was chemical use and people in and out of treatment repetitively. So we started using Circle of volunteers and committed community members in partnership with the referral sources, whether that was from family services, from the court, however that is designed. We saw less revolving and repeat treatments, and the cost of paying for treatment and out-of-home placements for the children while parents went to treatment was reduced. And so we kept applying the same model of Circle and peacemaking Circle. They're sometimes used interchangeably, is a way of delivering restorative process. It's one way. There's many other ways that are listed in here. And a lot of the language is to provide that balance because all of these processes are voluntary. So in Yellow Medicine County, at the end of the day, if someone does not want to participate or be involved in the community effort, then if it's something that came from court, they then proceed with the traditional justice system through the court. If it's a referral from family services for child protection case for Circle, and this family says, no, we don't want to do that, it proceeds traditionally through child protection. So those are like some of the ways that I can see provides kind of that balance, is that this is in partnership in each community with the referral sources on what works best for all of us. And the language here is to keep in mind that a lot of the children and families that we have a lot of trauma, have a lot of things that we need to take into consideration. So the length of time it may take to create change is longer. This has been an evolution for Yellow Medicine County over a long period of time. Anything else?
I can go ahead.
Yep, thank you, Madam Chair. And I would just jump in to say that, like, this sort of philosophy and this approach, I would say, is like the opposite of partisan. I feel like part of the way I approach this work is because I've spent 2 years in the company of restorative justice experts, and trying to like listen to people to be really thoughtful about all of the context for all of our interactions. And so I'm open to conversations about this language. I know that the Department of Public Safety doesn't love that we put the job description or the requirements for the job into the language of the bill. But that's kind of where it comes from. It's definitely not intended for it to be like a certain political viewpoint.
And can I just ask too, are there videos available that you could share with the committee of this in action, Ms. Hendricks? That you know of? Okay, no. I didn't know if there were any, even not necessarily from Yellow Medicine, but just in general, we can see this practice in action.
We invite people who would like to learn to attend the process, but because it's confidential and involves children and families, we don't video. There may be others who are here today who could speak to that. If they've videoed just for training purposes, we don't do that to protect the sacredness of the process.
That makes sense. I didn't know if there was like a training, just a, you know, kind of a mock experience that we could see. I think that would be helpful, but go ahead, Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and perhaps this is something we can add to the growing list of interim field trips that we're gonna take. Because yeah, I mean, I think that is, and I very much appreciate the effort at trying to explain it. As has kind of been a recurring theme with a lot of the stuff that we've talked about in this committee, it's an issue of experience. You know, when I talk about a cop, everybody knows what that is. When I talk about going to jail, everybody has a vision in their head of what that looks like. If I go to my constituents and I start talking about restorative justice, that doesn't mean anything to them because it's not something that they're engaging with. It's not something that's portrayed in media. It's a novel concept to them. And so as we move forward, I would just suggest that in order to ensure that it remains broadly supported and nonpartisan, we make what efforts we can to try to communicate the reality of that experience, and maybe it involves field trips.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Feist, for this bill. You know, restorative justice has different meaning to a lot of different people, and what that looks like. I guess as much as I want, you know, I was a teacher for a long time, and making sure that I would always try to dig deeper to try to understand what was happening with my students when they were acting out in my classroom. And this is very different than that in the sense, I mean, similar but different in the sense that, you know, these people are, some of these youth are intentionally making some really horrible choices. And it's not just forgetting homework or having an outburst out in class. These are intentional choices of committing crimes. And so the practice is the same. At the same time, it's very drastically different. I did want to say that while I have been very supportive in my local community of trying to make sure how we can support our youth, and I appreciate you saying how we want this to be driven by our local communities, the part of me that kind of hurts my heart a little bit, if I'm allowed to say it that way, is that, you know, we often spend so much more money trying to develop a new commission than actually just giving it to our local communities and asking them to go and do what they see in our own communities. So with that, I have the bill has a couple of appropriations, but we have not seen a fiscal note. So if there's a way that you could shed some light on that, that would be fantastic. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Vice Chair Feist.
Yep, thank you. We do not have a fiscal note yet because this was a very complicated bill, and we just finally finished the updated draft. And so I told the fiscal staff not to do a fiscal note on the original structure, which was very different, much more of a mandate, much more prescriptive, and much clunkier. So we will have a fiscal note, but I think, like, my vision for this is that we would fund the office and that staff, and that we would also then fund significant amount of grants that would go to the local communities. We have I believe it's $25,000 to $500,000 per grant that we would distribute across the state. And the goal here is to increase, you know, a big part of the role is public awareness and technical assistance, increasing knowledge of and use of restorative practices statewide. So my hope is that we can direct some state funds, because ultimately, as you see in your materials, the cost is relative, because we have the 10-year period in Yellow Madison County where their out-of-home placement costs went from about $500,000 to about $55,000. So there might be some upfront cost, but ultimately the decrease in recidivism, the ability of folks, like you've heard in some of the testimony, to go on to lead productive, contributing lives in our communities, I think will ultimately, ideally, pay for itself.
Any follow-up? Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Feist, for that. I appreciate the little bit of clarity on that and understanding that this is a complex system, and anything that we kind of do at one time also has effects on the other side. Mm-hmm. I would like to say, just to state, you know, the other bill that you had last week, 1300, I think was what it was. You know, we're talking about recidivism rate right now at 8 or 9%, which is laudable and is obviously a drastic decrease from what just going to traditional jail is. However, the bill that we were talking about on Friday, was it Friday?
It was, but we're talking about this bill. So you're,
I would like to say real briefly, okay, just comparing, you know, that had a recidivism rate of 1%. And so when we're looking at that, you know, making sure that we do strike the balance of holding people accountable and that we are doing the restorative piece is really important. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Vice Chair Feist.
Yep, thank you. I don't know if we can really, it's kind of apples to oranges, looking at those scenarios where it's people, I don't know, I think it's a very different demographic that we're talking about. The goal with restorative justice here is to intervene. I guess I'll just say that I don't know that I see the comparison.
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Feist. I appreciate this bill. And I just wanted to speak to a couple of the points that were brought up today. One, we've done a lot of work at looking at crime, looking at the roots of crime, and looking at how to deal with crime and reduce rates of recidivism. We've looked at that from so many different angles. And I just kind of wanted to ground us in that. This is one angle. This is one piece of the puzzle that can absolutely be a huge help, especially when we have folks involved who have the knowledge and understanding of the many different things that could drive a person to commit crime. And we know that oftentimes poverty is a cause of that, right? Like somebody goes to the grocery store in my community and they steal a grocery cart full of food. They're not going to go necessarily and sell that. That's probably for their family because they don't have what they need, and that's a risk that people take. And so I would also just like to speak to when we put a job description in a statute, I will say that's not unusual. And I've had the unique experience of working in human resources and in public safety. And I know that on the human services side, we do put expectations for specific positions in statute, where we say this is a minimum criteria. We want to make sure that we have folks who are experienced and have the knowledge in this specific realm. And I would say if we didn't do that, what we would be doing, we would be removing experience, knowledge, and understanding from the requirement of this position. So I'm actually in support of that, and I actually would say that it makes it easier for departments and for agencies, makes it easier to recruit and hire for positions when it's very clear what the expectation is. So I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Lead Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Representative Feist, going from the bill to the DE that you put in, you've made a lot of work and a lot of changes, and I appreciate that. Under Section 3, you've got the Board of Trustees section and funding to go to the Board of Trustees and the juvenile alternative. Can you expand on that, and what is the mission of the universities to be involved in this, and how are they going to be providing services?
I'm so sorry. I didn't quite hear. Did you say Section 3? So we're talking about...
Under the Section 3 for the Board of Trustees, we've got $500,000 mm-hmm. to the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. And then it talks on line 721 about the appropriation of $280,000, including the juvenile detention alternatives. Can you explain what that is and expand on that, please?
Vice Chair Feist.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the question. So this funding and the JDAI already exist. This is just moving it from being directly within the Department of Corrections to being within Metro State. And my understanding is just that this is a collaboration between the Department of Corrections and Metro State, and that everybody is on board to transition this program and that funding there, that will lead to better outcomes, more opportunities for collaboration. Metro State does a lot of applied research and analysis around criminal law. And so that's my understanding of why this was done. And I do not see Deputy Commissioner Curtis Shanklin here, so he'll have to let me speak. Oh, is he? Where are you? Oh, hey, you're right there. Would you like to hear from Deputy Commissioner?
I don't know if we have time. Oh, okay. We still have another bill. Sorry
okay.
about that.
Hopefully I explained
it. But I'm glad you're here, and maybe Lead Novotny can check in with you after committee if needed.
I would be happy to do that, Chair. And I think we'll wrap with, Yellow Medicine shows that these programs can be done successfully on a local level. We did them in Sherburn County. We've got all these different counties that are doing it at a federal level. And to kind of just repeat what Representative Mueller said, I think the more we can do locally, Mueller, Representative Mueller said, I think if we just put the money on the ground in the places where it's going to be working, it would be my preference. But thank you, Chair.
Great. Any closing comments, Vice Chair Feist?
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Novotny, that is the vision for this bill, to fund and provide awareness and technical support for local communities to build their own restorative justice programs. We just need someone who is a true expert with a lot of institutional
knowledge about how to implement and grow these programs to provide that assistance. And that's what other states have done, and so that's why it's structured the way it is to create that office. But ultimately, and you know the difference between my original version, where we were like, this is what we want you to do, and this is what you have to do. And so we've transitioned it to try to give much more power to the local communities to build their own. In closing, I'll just say that, you know, this, you know, we talked about recidivism rates. They're really meaningful and impressive in this context, but also one of the things that I was told by someone was that what is most striking to them is that the experience of those people who have been harmed by the actions of these kids was universally, like, a better, more healing experience when they went through this restorative path. And that is what this bill is ultimately about. It's about healing. And I'll leave it at that. I love this bill. I hope you will, too.
Thanks again. And thank you for the testifiers for being here today and to all those who submitted letters of support that are in the packets and that are posted online. I renew my motion and lay over House File 46 as amended. The last bill we have on the agenda today is House File 2078. It's a Representative Edelson bill. I will move to lay over House File 2078. I do see, Representative Edelson, that you have an A1 amendment. And so I will, there, you have a lot of papers, but I think it's not for this bill. Hopefully it's for something else.
It was for something else.
I will move the A1 amendment. Would you please explain what the A1 amendment does?
I apologize, Madam Chair. I actually don't have the A1 amendment. I'm clearly, I think it just inserts in the numbers. Thank you.
I think that's right. It has the appropriations inserted into it. So yes. Any discussion to the A1 amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye. 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 Opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Edelson, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize. Yes, I had a massive bill up before this. Okay, so House File 2078 would appropriate, as you amended, $250 per year for 2024 and then $250 for 2025. So these are nonprofit organizations to increase their physical security against terrorist and extremist attacks by securing entrances and installing video monitors. This is a grant program that houses of worship, summer camp, school, and social services can use. We have funded this in the past. Members, I want to highlight that mosques and synagogues deal with specifically crime-related problems at a much larger average than a church. Even my own synagogue, I am Jewish, and we have to have security guards because of threat that we've had to our temple. Just last year in Minneapolis, a mosque was burglarized, and it was $50,000 of damage. But not only that, think about what that means for that house of worship. People don't feel safe. So with this, the nonprofit security grant program is a competitive grant program that's appropriated annually through the Department of Homeland Security. Currently, Minnesota receives far less than our proportional share of these federal dollars. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll go to my testifiers.
Thank you. First up, we have Rob Allen, and then we have Ryan Fouts. So if you both want to make your way down, that would be great. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rob Allen. I'm the Director of Community Security for the Jewish Community Relations Council of Minnesota and Dakotas. The security team at JCRC works with more than 50 organizations serving more than 65,000 Jews in Minnesota. I know you all have a one-pager that explains how the program works. If you have questions about that later, I'll be happy to, but I want to address the need for the program. Both the FBI and the U.S. Department of Homeland Security have identified domestic violent extremists as the greatest threat to the nation's homeland security. Religious-based hate crimes are second only to race-related hate crimes in frequency. While Jews make up between 2 and 3% of the population in the country, about 60% of religious-based hate crimes are perpetrated against Jewish people. And we certainly have seen that activity in Minnesota. Members of our community have been the victims of assault, vandalism, and last summer an extremist group based here drove through several communities distributing leaflets in plastic bags weighted down with quarantine beans or pebbles that contained racist, homophobic, Islamophobic, and vilely anti-Semitic messages. Mosques, churches, and synagogues, as well as other nonprofit organizations, have a serious security challenge. They are called to be open and welcoming, but are also targeted by those who want to cause harm. To its credit, the federal government has recognized the importance of hardening the soft targets presented by these institutions that serve the public, but that may be targeted by extremists. Unfortunately, less than $1 million of the $270 million allocated to these institutions by the federal government ended up in Minnesota organizations. The investments in security that organizations make through the Nonprofit Security Grant Program are not done lightly by the organizations. They often have to do extensive fundraising to find the upfront funds needed, which often aren't reimbursed for a year or more, and the application process is long and time-consuming for organizations that are often volunteer-driven. But our institutions realize that this is the best way that we continue to that we can continue to serve the public and maintain the security of those who participate. Giving Minnesota organizations a chance to increase their safety and security by supplementing the federal nonprofit security grant program allows more institutions to become safer and continue their valuable work. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, we have Ryan Fouts. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Moeller and committee members. My name is Ryan Fouts. I use they, he pronouns, and I'm the executive director of Reclaim. Reclaim is a nonprofit that provides mental health care to queer and trans youth ages 12 to 25 throughout the Twin Cities and greater Minnesota. And we're one of the only organizations in the state that focuses on providing specialized mental health care to this population. So far, 8 states have passed some form of a ban on gender-affirming care, and 23 others are currently considering a ban. With the governor's executive order establishing Minnesota as a trans refuge, we're showing the country that we're not afraid to be a place where all people are welcomed, respected, and valued. However, this means that we face increased threats from those who feel they have the right to harass, discriminate against, or cause harm to the LGBTQ+ community. There are numerous hate groups that spread misinformation about gender-affirming care and its providers, and we know that this messaging encourages people to react with violence. Minnesota's care providers have experienced death threats. In Savage, a man who was arrested for having illegal weapons expressed admiration for the Club Q shooter in Colorado Springs. And there's a group called the Gender Mapping Project that says they, quote, offer no apologies for our dedication to abolishing the gender industry, and we don't make excuses for our hard-lined approach, end quote. I don't hear this as a simple disagreement or difference of opinion. I hear it as a threat against my community, against our life-saving work, and against our clients and staff. At Reclaim, most of our revenue comes from the community, so we strive to direct as much money as possible to the ongoing support of our mission. But we also have security issues to address to minimize the threat of harm to our clients and staff. We're working on a federal grant application, but it's competitive, and if our grant isn't approved, then making necessary security upgrades means less money to put towards our services. Please support House File 2078 to create an additional safety net of funds. We want to provide as much care as possible to queer and trans youth, and we need to be able to do so as safely as possible. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony. Thanks to both of you for being here today. We did not have any other members of the public sign up to testify, so we can move on to member discussion. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Edelson, for carrying this bill. You know, I'm one of these guys from the suburbs. I go to a Catholic church. Never in the world did I ever think I would be approached at church by somebody that wanted to harm me and my family. That happened this year. And for this, we need these bills. It's really sad that we're at this point for people that want to be safe in a place that's safe. I never thought I would be threatened at my own church, but I was. And I think we really need to step up here. So thank you for bringing this bill.
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. And I'll echo a little bit of what Representative Hewitt said. Representative Edelson, I really appreciate this bill. And I look at this, you know, when we're here in the Public Safety Committee, a lot of times we're talking about, you know, violations of state statute, criminal code, right? But, or we might talk about some public health concerns that fall under public safety. But today we're talking about something serious in the country, and thankfully it's, you know, not extremely pervasive, but we know it's an issue, is domestic terrorism. And when I look at, you know, the organizations that are affected by this, that are positively affected by the funds in this bill, these are vulnerable places, and these are places where people go to be vulnerable and to share in community with people. And so I think it's really important. You know, we had the last testifier from Reclaim, Mr. Fouts, talk about how nonprofits have to raise all this money to just do their work, and churches mm-hmm. have to raise their money just to do the good work that they're trying to do. And so to try to raise enough for security that we know is crazy expensive, it's very, very, very expensive. I would love for those funds that they raise to go to the heart of their missions. So I really support this, and I would like to see more bills like this. So thank you.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Edelson, for bringing this. It is necessary. I'm glad to support it. I feel like this might be a good moment to speak perhaps to people who see the world more my way. It's never okay to lash out violently against people you disagree with. And the moment you do that, the moment you cross the line into initiating force against another person, you're not one of my people. And that's something that has to be said. I mean, you know, this week we're going to be having some conversations that are going to be very difficult on the House floor. And there's things going on nationally, potentially today, that are going to be interesting. But the case has been made, and it needs to be said that folks like us who are in positions of influence should be categorically condemning and speaking against efforts at violence. And that's where I'm at. No qualifications. Thank you.
Further member discussion? Closing comments, Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I think there's a lot to that, Representative Hudson, because violence has spiked in the last decade. And I think a lot of that does go to rhetoric, whether or not you're in the LGBTQ community, or if you're a Jewish person, or a Muslim person, or a Hindu person, that we can have debates and have them in a respectful way, and that Representative Corinne, we should feel safe. And but we have to harden these institutions, because there's many times we're not. So it's unfortunate. I think we can all do better, and I just really appreciate the bipartisan support here today. Thank you.
Thank you. I renew my motion and lay over House File 2078 as amended. That concludes today's agenda. This meeting is adjourned.